This is Tori from the Dead Game Society. Welcome to our podcast, the DGS. We play with dead things.
Hello and welcome back to the Dead Game Society podcast. My name's Chad, and while normally I'd have my faithful co-hosts Michael and Colin at my side, for today's episode I'm flying solo as I have a special treat for all you Call Cthulhu fans out there. About a year or so ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing John Tynes, one of my favorite figures in the world of weird tabletop roleplay, and also a good friend of mine from our shared days back at the University of Missouri. Now, I had planned to present this interview a long time ago, but as DGS has only recently gotten our show going, it had unfortunately remained shelved. But I felt it just too good to remain in my hoard just for my ears alone, so today I present it to you. Enjoy. And welcome to the Dead Game Society podcast, the show where we discuss games and game editions no longer in print. Now, today it's my distinct pleasure to be speaking with one of my favorite game designers, as well as a friend from my college days, that being John Tynes. John is one of the founders of Pagan Publishing, where he brought us the Unspeakable Oath magazine and the critically acclaimed Call of Cthulhu game supplement, Delta Green. Now, John's also written such games as Puppet Land, Unknown Armies, and The Hills Rise Wild. But enough gushing from me. How are you this morning, John?
I am great. Thank you, Chad.
Well, you're welcome, John. Now, the first thing I'd like to, you know, as we get into this whole thing, I just want to first find out, what was the first game that you played? What was your gateway game?
Boy, you know, I started off playing... I guess D&D would have been my first game, probably when I was 12 or 13, somewhere in there. And that was just a friend of mine down the street, a neighbor of mine, who this kid who was a year or two older than me, I guess, and he was a big D&D nut. And so he had some of the books and wanted to get me to play. And so we did it, and for several years, he and I played together, you know, frequently, but it was the two of us, so all of my early gaming experiences were just, you know, one DM and one player, which was, you know, in retrospect was kind of mutant, but that was how we played. And so we had a great time with it, but then a friend of mine at school, I noticed, also had a D&D book or something, and so I, you know, began to talk about games, and it turned out that he had this game called Call of Cthulhu that was, you know, based on Lovecraft stuff. And I've been reading Lovecraft for a couple of years already because I'd found a tattered old paperback in my parents' library that contained Color Out of Space and some other stories. And so we played a little bit of Cthulhu in high school, and I, you know, I really dug that as well. But ultimately, that, like, there wasn't any really a group that could kind of do with it regularly. So it wasn't until college when I dove into Cthulhu every single week, and that was when I really got to play through, you know, Masks of Nyarlathotep and all these great stories and great campaigns, and that's where Pagan was formed, was out of the games club at my university. So it began with D&D, though, absolutely.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned the gaming club back at the University of Missouri. I remember that back in 91, 92, if I remember correctly, every Saturday they would host games there. And I always remember seeing you at your table, and generally speaking, I a lot of times I would see Dennis Detweiler and John Crow gathered around as you guys all played. And once you even let me in on your game, I think you were running the Horror on the Orient Express.
Oh, man. God, that was a clusterfuck. It was. That campaign I was very excited about. But it embodied a certain style of scenario design that Chaosium had really used a lot of over the years, which was this approach where the way the scenario would be written was just a linear series of scenes. And any given scene would end with, you know, if they make the library use roll, they advance to the next scene. And that was it. Like, if they didn't make the roll, apparently you were, you know, just too bad. Like, there's nowhere to go. And it just really came to bug me that they were really just kind of like stories or screenplays that were just written with a few die rolls along the way. And I really felt that to do this medium justice, you really needed to have a more varied path available to you. And so, driven a large part by the really great scenario writing of John Crow at Pagan, we found this format where our scenarios would present kind of like, here's an initial situation, here's a timeline, what's going to be happening, here's all the major characters and locations involved, here are some events along that timeline, go. And so rather than set it out as a linear series of scenes, we kind of just created this framework within which things were going to happen if the players didn't intervene. But they had the freedom to do their own interviews, investigations, and find the right places to intervene and what to go after. And so it made for a much more player-directed narrative than what we were seeing from Chaosium. And to me, Orient Express was a classic of that Chaosium form. You know, the scenarios were very, very linear, lead you by the nose, just one is A, B, C, D. And I ultimately, around that time, realized that and kind of began to get frustrated with what they were doing.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, I think that's not just an issue with Call of Cthulhu. I think a lot of games have the issue where the characters tend to be led by the nose through the adventure. There's a way to do things. You should really do it this way. If you don't do it this way, you know, it's not really written into the adventure. What will happen if they don't do this? It's really more left up to the GM to kind of decide the consequences of actions. But I think you guys did a good job, though, with your scenarios and giving pretty much other options that a player can pursue. Now, one thing I also think you guys did really good is you really built in a mechanism for adding new characters to the game as older characters die off. And of course, in Call of Cthulhu, characters die off really quick. So rather than, you know, having to figure out, well, why would this character join the group, you guys gave a pretty good rationale, especially just with Delta Green alone and its own premise, of why you would have other characters coming in to take the place of, you know, characters that have left. You know, how'd that come to be? What was the thought process that prompted you guys towards that direction?
Yeah, I mean, so, well, more or less. I mean, the scenario design thing itself, and it was across all the stuff that we did. But Delta Green and Golden Dawn specifically were both created because we just had this problem in our own campaigns. We were playing Massive Alphatep, and, you know, we're in Egypt or someplace, and we're at a hotel, and one of our characters has died or gone insane or whatever, been kidnapped or something, and the player is still there, and we're in the middle of a session, you know, and their character's gone. And so we have to just drum up on the spot some kind of a reason why they can roll up a new character and jump back into the game. And, you know, at this point, we're a batch of, you know, half-crazed, you know, maniacal murderers running across the globe trying to save the world. And the idea that in this hotel in Egypt in the middle of the night, we would suddenly bump into some guy in the lobby and be like, hey, come join us, you know, I mean, it just didn't make sense. It was just kind of nuts.
Yeah. You're like, hey, why don't you come join us? We're going to take out the thing that should not be in the Black Pyramid.
Right, exactly. It's a nice place, you know. Yeah, I know. In Masks, we kept, in London, we kept renting trucks, you know, like big lorries. And then, of course, we'd lose them because they'd be destroyed in combat with a hunting horror, because we'd run off the road and crash, or we'd abandon them into the scene of the crime and run away. And so after a while, our keeper, John Crow, kept raising the price of rentals for trucks, because in the market, we were just using them all up. You know, we were just burning through so many, and we're just getting around. Like, some guys are, like, stealing all the trucks. What the hell? That was just...
just think if you had based all your campaigns in Detroit. But, yeah, you know, I mean, we joke about it. But really, you know, that is a big thing in gaming is... You know, I don't know how many times I hear players say, what's my motivation for doing this? Why would I do this? And with Delta Green, you guys really gave us good motivation for why our characters would go out and and do this? Why would we join up with these obviously suicidal people to go take out the great old ones, you know? And you guys did a really good job with that. You know, the very organization itself, Delta Green, gives you that in. It gives you the plot hook. Which leads me to wonder, was the plot hook kind of why you guys did Delta Green?
Delta Green and Golden Dawn came about because we wanted kind of like campaign frameworks so that when we were playing a game, like if you're playing in the 1890s for Golden Dawn or Delta Green in the modern day, and you lost a character, that there was some kind of a fallback, that there was a structure in place that made sense where you could turn to this organization or this group of people and recruit a new player character from them. And it would feel okay. It would feel like it actually made sense in the story and kind of helped everything hang together. And we did those too because I told Chaos at the time that, you know, you guys are doing the 20s hot and heavy, so we'll go off and do Victorian era and the modern day with these two campaign frameworks and campaigns and see if that'll help out. And to me, it just made a huge difference because it just felt like it just kind of helped the whole thing hang together better as a story. And that was something that was always very important to me.
Now with Delta Green, you guys really gave us a great backstory, starting all the way back with its in-character formation after the Innsmouth raid, I should say. But while the included timeline you give could allow for game masters to branch off into other points of Delta Green's history, and by the way, it's a great timeline given in that book. It really covers some key moments, real moments in history, as well as moments in character history. But as I was saying, you guys stayed pretty true though to the gameplay set in the 90s when it actually comes to the gameplay itself. Now obviously GMs could use the timeline that you include to branch off into other points of Delta Green's already established history. Why didn't you produce formal material for those earlier points that you list?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true. You know, we kind of pulled that thing together, the whole history of Delta Green, and it goes all the way back to the raid on Innsmouth way back when in 1920s, I guess it was, for Lovecraft. I mean, it's tough to say. Like, there's so many different, you know, areas that are interesting. I mean, and Chaosium has published little experiments in this stuff. You know, they've done some stuff in ancient Rome and Elizabethan era and so forth. And I mean, it's all fun. You know, it's good stuff. I think that, you know, at the time at Pagan, we were so slow to get books out the door that it was more important to us to kind of like stay focused on a specific era with Delta Green and just kind of keep doing more stuff for that, instead of branching out into other areas as well. Because ultimately, you know, this is kind of a problem in the role-playing game hobby in general. There's so many groups with so many different games and their own homebrew campaigns and so forth that, you know, it's a really splintered audience. And so as a publisher, it was important to us to try to put our chips in as few places as possible to where we might actually reach a broader audience within the gaming community.
I think it's interesting that you guys opted to create Delta Green as a setting for the already established Call of Cthulhu rather than just creating your own unique game. So many people, you know, these days, especially that with the self-publishing online and everything making it so easy, of course, you really see a lot of people trying to create their own games. What made you guys decide that rather than creating your own game, you were really going to make a supplement for an already existing game? What went into that decision?
You know, I mean, we were such nuts for Cthulhu. And that's really what brought us together as a group was just our love for Call of Cthulhu and for Lovecraft. And so, I mean, everything we were doing was based around that material, basically. And plus offshoots like King in Yellow and Robert Chambers. So, I mean, there was a period when we talked about, began to look at concepts for other games, and Godlike came out of that effort. But whenever we would do that, frankly, we just couldn't agree on what new game we might do. You know, like what we always came back to was, well, Cthulhu's what brought us together. So we just kind of stayed there and used it as a launch pad to do, you know, our own things. And so we did all kinds of different books for Cthulhu and pursued many different kind of styles of it. But that was the glue for us as Cthulhu.
Now, as you may or may not remember, I've always been a big fan of the spy genre, and Delta Green seems really rooted in the in that shadowy world of covert operations. In fact, there's a really detailed section in back in the back of the book that covers some of the various clandestine organizations. So did the various real-life agencies, such as the CIA itself or MI6, form a model for Delta Green?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's kind of reflected in the timeline. I mean, it's been a while since I've reviewed that stuff, but, you know, Delta Green is kind of this project within the OSS, and the OSS gets shut down after World War II, and then the CIA gets spun back up, and Delta Green isn't really part of that, but kind of has its own, sees its own opportunity to kind of reform and relaunch. That, a lot of that came from Scott Glancy, one of the co-authors on the original Delta Green book, because he had a deep passion for the history of espionage and law enforcement, and he'd been a prosecutor and had even interviewed with the CIA at one point. And his, you know, that was kind of his area of interest and passion in particular. And so much of that history, you know, I think we kind of sketched it out over the phone in very broad strokes. But he kind of dug into a lot of the specific incidents and so forth from history that he could kind of weave into Delta Green. And Dennis Tyler and I, you know, did a lot of kibitzing and feedback and suggestions and kind of that whole section, that whole historical timeline of Delta Green, you know, grew over several years of ongoing development as we kept doing more research and pulling more stuff in there and so forth. And certainly it's informed by Scott's thesis of the development of the intelligence community in the U.S., which is that it always has grown up as this very fragmented thing, unlike the big kind of, you know, fascist organizations around the country, around the world, like the Soviet Union or whatever at the time, or Germany, that had, you know, very top-down, top-directed intelligence agencies where they had, like, one monolithic organization to do everything. In the U.S., it's always been fragmented. It's funny, I was just reading last night in the paper about the Defense Department is creating a new global intelligence agency that's called the Defense Something Agency. It's a brand new intelligence agency that is meant to not provide intelligence for troops on the ground, but is really meant to provide like counterterrorism, counterproliferation kind of information across the world. And you know, I read this whole article and I was thinking, like, why do we need this? You know, we've got the CIA, we've got all kinds of organizations, but because of the nature of our democracy and kind of our decentralized bureaucracy that we've got, there are always groups in various parts of government and the military that are eager to build their own fiefdoms and want to build out their own war organizations, their own, get their own slice of the pie. And so this thing I was reading about, the Defense Clandestine Agency, I think it was called, is just another example. You know, like these things are everywhere. It's why I asked Scott to do those kind of dossiers in the back of the Delta Green book about all the different organizations you might work for in the federal government. And he took me farther than I ever expected. I mean, he really went nuts with that stuff. But the reality is there are so many different fragmented groups in the government that have intelligence or law enforcement powers that it's a really, you know, it's kind of an unusual thing about American government. And it makes perfect sense in that context that something like Delta Green after World War II would get spun up alongside the CIA and, you know, the FBI was preceding that, but kind of in that same time period, roughly. And other organizations as well began to spring up. And in the 50s, we got, you know, the NSA and so forth. And it just kind of keeps growing and growing. And so absolutely it paralleled the CIA at that point because the CIA was emblematic of how intelligence agencies in this country got started then and still today.
Now, in Delta Green, there's this definite emphasis on UFO phenomena. In fact, you set up the Mego, who we first see from H.P. Lovecraft himself in his story, The Whisperer in Darkness. In Delta Green, you set up the Mego as the primary alien menace, the visitors, you might say. How did they become the central threat in Delta Green?
That was very much, as I recall, it was very much Dennis Duttweiler. That was kind of his baby, was the Mego stuff. You know, we were all familiar with Majestic 12 from all the conspiracy nonsense that had gone on. But I think it was Dennis's particular infatuation with the Mego that kind of led us down that path. And I think he may have been the one that had the idea of the Mego actually being the Greys, like wearing them as suits or whatever. I think that might have come from Dennis. This is stuff that we were all really into. I mean, when I was a kid, my parents were in a UFO society, basically. And so they would meet every month and talk about UFOs and bring in speakers. You know, they had J. Allen Hynek come through and give a talk and so forth. And the group was organizing, you know, like watch duty rotations to watch the sky for UFOs. And for a couple of years, my parents' phone number, where I lived as a kid, was listed with the airport and the police and the county police for people that called up to say they saw a UFO or whatever. And when they did, then my parents were like, you know, Mulder and Scully, and they'd go out there and interview the people and take notes and write up a report and so forth. And so they ended up responding to calls for several different UFO sightings and even a Bigfoot sighting, of all things. So I grew up in that context. And so, you know, and Dennis and Scott likewise were always fascinated with that kind of material. And so we just saw it as this great opportunity to weave together all these things we were passionate about. We're just kind of, we had the precedent, of course, from H.P. Lovecraft's Whisper in Darkness, where one of the Mego has replaced Henry Akeley at the end of the story and is wearing, you know, his face and hands or wax replicas or something of them and posing as a human. And so from there, it's a very short trip to go, well, if they can do that, they could be posing as the Greys, and they could be the puppet masters behind all this, you know, all this nonsense that's going on.
Okay, well, Pagan Publishing has always been very much about getting the details of gameplay right, starting with the articles that we see in The Unspeakable Oath. That attention to detail really came across to me as a player and game master and showed that Pagan Publishing was attempting to get it right in the translation of real-world activities to the gameplay table. One of these that first comes to mind, one good example of this, would be a issue, one of the early issues of Unspeakable Oath. I always remember there was an article that gave really good rules on firearms for roleplay. Can you talk about how that article came to be?
Yeah, you know, when I started The Unspeakable Oath, Crow was in the gaming group, of course, and I asked the guys there who I was playing with, if I told them about the Oath, my plan for this crazy magazine, and asked if they wanted to do anything for it. Crow came back with a proposal to write a series of articles about firearms of the 1920s. And so he began that. I think we ran that series for the first, oh, I don't know, like 4 or 5 issues of The Oath, somewhere in there. And he also did a follow-up about automobiles of the time period. And that work led him on to kind of revise and consolidate all that, plus a lot more material, into a book called The Weapons Compendium. And we did, I forget, probably 3 or 4 editions of that book over the years through Pagan. And it was mostly a giant list of firearms appropriate to the time period, along with information about them and their workings and so forth. And it was interesting stuff. You know, it was kind of a thing he was very enthusiastic about as kind of a, you know, a researcher of firearms and history and whatnot. And it was definitely a useful tool for players. Certainly for to some players saw it as just like a giant catalog of, you know, how to shoot things or whatever. But frankly, I mean, everything about Cthulhu, even at Cassium, was so research-oriented in creating the material, because it's set, you know, typically Call of Cthulhu is set in a historical time period, and so, you know, when we began to work on these projects, historical research is an important part of it. You know, for Golden Dawn, we had a lot of great material coming in, and I was looking for a way to pull it together, and I was digging into, I can't remember exactly how I got there, but I was reading about the history of William Butler Yeats, who was one of the founders of the Golden Dawn, one of the primary leaders of the organization, I should say. And from reading about Yeats and his poetry and his life and so on, I came across this concept of the Sheila na Gig, which is in particularly in Irish history, and I think across the UK, are these sort of carved stone images that are found in old churches and castles and other kind of stone structures, typically over archways. And there are these figures that are kind of these weird, emaciated female figures, where you can see their ribs and their heads are usually larger proportionally than their bodies than they should be. They almost look like, kind of like grays. And they're always sort of, it's bizarre to talk about, but they have their hands in their genitals, kind of like this distended depiction of their genitals. And it's this very familiar carving that sometime in the Middle Ages, maybe earlier, just popped up all over these churches and castles. And whatever reason why these things existed at one time was lost. Today, literally no one has any idea why these things exist. It's just this weird thing that happened at some point in history and then stopped. And many of them were destroyed in the Victorian era. You know, of course, they were kind of weird and sexual and so forth. And so many of them were chipped away and discarded, but some still exist. And so reading about that, about Yeats and the Sheila na Gigs, you know, you begin to think about, well, Sheila na Gig, that sounds kind of like Shub-Niggurath, and, you know, next thing you know, that turns into a major plot line in Golden Dawn. And so that kind of research has happened all the time with our stuff. We were always digging through obscure books. You know, we had a set of encyclopedias from about 1930, I think, that we kept in the house, that we were always pulling off the shelf and looking up random weird things. In part because, you know, if you're doing adventures around the world, then of course the maps have all changed, you know, and so you want to make sure you've got the right geography and the capital cities and even what the countries were named and so forth. So our whole approach was research heavy and informed everything we did. And the Weapons Compendium was a highly visible example of that, but everything we were doing was informed by that kind of discipline.
So now, aside from Delta Green, you were also very instrumental in producing another game, Unknown Armies. Can you tell me a little bit about Unknown Armies?
Well, it certainly is one of my very favorite projects of the years. Unknown Armies is in some ways the inverse of Call of Cthulhu. It's a contemporary occult kind of horror game where instead of, you know, faceless gods or vast conspiracies, it's simply the human race itself that is at the heart of all reality. And so there are these kind of ascended humans who kind of build the reality that we live in. And they're called, they're known as the invisible clergy. And they kind of, essentially, if a concept or a, you know, an agenda or something becomes widespread enough in humanity, then some kind of an exemplar of that concept is transformed into one of these kind of eternal beings living in some kind of, you know, possibility space and up in the ether. And once there are, and then they then kind of represent and kind of promote subconsciously, effectively, whatever the concept is. And so when we have, for example, you know, the idea of sort of liberated women coming into cultural currency around the world, then in this case, the avatar known as the Flying Woman ascends. And in the world, you know, on the armies, that was originally Amelia Earhart. She essentially was, like, shirred up out of the plane during her trip and joined this kind of, you know, invisible clergy up in the heavens. And once there's only space in that clergy for 333 people. And once that they're all full, the world ends, and then the clergy reforms a new world based on whatever combinations of passion humanity had kind of embraced. And so they make a new version of it, essentially, and everyone gets reborn again, but now the world is shaped by the passions of the last world. And so the world we live in today in Unknown Armies is the world we deserve. It's the world that our humanity has built. And so if we think that, you know, if we're annoyed by, like, oh God, there's war and there's suffering and there's plague and so forth, it's because we made it. It's because we made this world that we live in. And we're responsible for it. And so in Unknown Armies, we have that notion of humanity's passions carries down to the individual level. When you make a character in Unknown Armies, part of your character creation process is you decide what your passions are. Like, what things are you most committed to? What are you most afraid of? And so every single character you play in Unknown Armies, just the beginning, is not simply a set of elemental attributes. They also have this kind of soulfulness as well. They have these very human passions and things that drive them crazy or that they're terrified of or whatever. So you begin the game with very committed, engaged people as your characters. And so, and you're involved in these kind of subcultural intrigues in the occult underground all based around, more or less, around manipulating this invisible clergy, trying to promote the ascension of specific people into specific roles up there, or even to pull down an avatar that has ascended to the clergy and replace them with a kind of a modified version of that concept. And so an example of this is one of the traditional avatars that turns around most incarnations of the world is the messenger, someone who brings, you know, messages and information from one place to another. So in Unknown Armies, there's a guy named Dermot Arcane who is trying to top the messenger and take his place. And Arcane's version of the messenger, who actually corrupts and makes uncertain the messages he delivers. And if you think about the mass media today, whether it's, you know, MSNBC or Fox or you know, pundits and so forth, all of whom are taking what might have once been considered objective truth and are turning it entirely into spin, manipulated content, you understand why a concept like the messenger would kind of make more sense for the world we're living in now. And so in the armies, they're having these struggles over who's going to take these seats, these thrones up in the sky, basically. And it's kind of a race, because when the last one gets up there, like the lights go out, and the world ends, and is born instantly. And now the world has changed into its next incarnation. So Unknown Armies is this very kind of grubby, desperate game of really violent, passionate, committed, crazy people who can use magic and all kinds of weird artifacts and so forth against each other, all competing for this very, very, you know, the swiftly dwindling set of resources of these thrones up in the sky, basically. And no one knows it's happening. And they kind of want to keep it that way, because it's easier to manipulate people when they don't know you're doing it, when they don't even know you're doing it. So that's Unknown Armies in a nutshell. And for me, as with most of my work in games, Unknown Armies was a way to new set of filters or prisms to look at the world through. And that to me is what I always found most interesting about games, was not there for their own sake, but for how I could use them to explore the world we actually live in. That was much more interesting to me than the actual gameplay in some cases. So Unknown Armies is a way to look at, you know, if you've known people in your life, you know, really extreme and obsessive and kind of hard to deal with, then Unknown Armies is a way to think about what those people might be like and why they might be that way. If you've known someone in your life, for example, who at some point decided to just, like, sell off almost all their crap, burn all their bridges, not talk to anyone they ever knew again, and leave town, just walk out of your life and the lives of everyone you knew, in Unknown Armies, there's a reason for that. You know, we have these kind of magical schools that people follow, and one of them, Annihilomancy, is this kind of magical school where you can gain great power if you're willing to burn down everything in your life. It's the kind of thing you can't do every week, but, you know, if you're working towards a big goal, at some point you're willing to surrender all the people in your life and all your relationships and all your history for the sake of gaining power. And if you're one of these passionate, you know, kind of street-fighting warriors in the occult underground, then you'll do that. And so to me, Unknown Armies was my best shot at finding a way to explain and explore how the world works and how people work. And that's kind of been a guiding force across all my work.
Okay, so you had done Deltagreen, you had done Unknown Armies, but you've been involved in other games as well. You all were also involved in Godlike and The Hills Run Wild. Tell us a little bit about how all that came to be.
Sure. So after Deltagreen and Countdown, I guess, somewhere in there, at Pagan, I came to the conclusion that we really had to move beyond doing licensed Call of Cthulhu books. And as I mentioned earlier, we'd tried to come up with a couple different game ideas before, and just it was just kind of hard to find anything to rally around. But I decided that, you know, rather than try to find the one true game we could all agree on, which is you know, kind of a nightmare, we should just begin placing some bets on different things. And so we spun up two projects around that time period. One of them was Godlike. Dennis Stepwiller had this concept for a sort of a Saving Private Ryan superhero game. World War II with superheroes, but very gritty, where these super-powered soldiers are dying left and right. They're not all Superman or whatever. And it was a great idea, and I helped him brainstorm some of that stuff, but it was really his baby. And so we began working on that project. And at the same time, I began to work with my friend Jesper Mirfors, who had been the original art director on Magic the Gathering years before. And Jesper and I dreamed up this miniatures game called The Hills Rise Wild, which was bizarrely a H.P. Lovecraft hillbilly miniatures game, where you're it's sort of set in Dunwich, and the different factions are, you know, the Whatleys and the Deep Ones and so forth. And you're all kind of rampaging across the tabletop with your units, having this kind of just this mass free-for-all, trying to find the Necronomicon and summon your respective god to destroy the world. And it's a weird tongue-in-cheek, you know, turn-based miniatures game. It's big fun. It's a really good, larky, good time. And so Godlike and Hills Rise Wild were both, you know, kind of these sort of one-off products we began to put together to try to begin to diversify what we were doing at Pagan. And in that same time period, I had done a role-playing game called Puppetland that was kind of an experimental storytelling game that I published on my website, and ended up getting published in a British games magazine, and then a game company called Hogshead in the UK, run by my friend James Wallace, did a print edition of Puppetland, and I added new material for that, and we got artwork and so forth for it. At the same time, I guess, it wasn't around the same time, I'd had this concept for a comic book series called The New Inquisition that was a contemporary occult kind of project. And I've been dreaming up ideas for that project for a while, and had gotten as far as scripting the first issue and getting a really great artist I knew in town named Brian Snowdy to work on that. And so we'd done probably 6 or 8 pages of material for that comic book. But he got busy and I got busy and we dropped it. And so I had still was really kind of engaged with that concept and that setting, and I'd written a couple short stories for it. And so I recruited Greg Stolze, who was a writer and game designer that I knew, and he and I teamed up to turn my New Inquisition material into a full-on role-playing game. And that became Unknown Armies. And Unknown Armies was going to be published by a game company called Archon that died and went out of business before we published it, and so it ended up going to Atlas Games instead, run by my friend John Neff. And Atlas had done over the age, they'd done a lot of Ars Magica books, a lot of great, great games over the years. And so we did Unknown Armies with those guys, and Unknown Armies became something that I was involved with for another, I guess probably 4 or 5 years, I think, of running that line. So I served as a line editor for Unknown Armies. We did a series of source books, adventure packs, and so forth for it. And all this just kind of going on, you know, simultaneously with Pagan and Atlas and so forth. And I was just kind of, and in part of it, frankly, was that I was getting burnt on Cthulhu. I just had been doing Cthulhu for, you know, better part of, by then, probably 10 years, 12 years. And I just kind of run out of passion for it. And a lot of it is that I'm driven by solving problems. I love to solve interesting problems. And by 2002, after doing Pagan for 12 years, I just felt like, you know, I think I've solved like every problem that I care about in Call of Cthulhu.
Now, John, you have a new book out right now, don't you?
Yeah, so I've got a new book that just came out in March of this year called Delta Green Strange Authorities. And this is actually a compilation of all of my Delta Green fiction from over the years. And so there's, it's got a bunch of short stories in there, as well as my novel, Delta Green, The Rules of Engagement. And all put together between one set of covers. And that's available in soft cover and a limited hardcover, as well as Kindle and iBooks and Nook and ebook formats from Arc Dream Press. And I'm really glad to have this stuff out there, because various of these stories have been out of print, or, you know, were only ever available like on my website years ago, and I still ran my website regularly. And so they kind of had sort of fallen off into the ether, and I'm really happy to get them all together again. And in putting them together for the book, I arranged them in chronological order of when they happened in the Delta Green timeline. And that was really fun to look at and to realize just how much they overlap. Because the very first story in the book, The Corn King, features David Mills, who is a main character in the last story in the book, the Rules of Engagement novel. He's the agent that goes missing at the beginning of the book, who's been kidnapped by Majestic, basically. And so he actually kind of bookends the whole thing, as it turns out. And characters from the different stories in my book all kind of overlap and interweave and so forth. And it was kind of fun to look back at that stuff and realize just how many common threads I was pulling together. And so having it all together in one place, arranged in sequence, you actually are going to get a much bigger picture of what's going on than would have been possible with each individual piece.
So can we assume that the stories in your book will be covering the origins, the early period of Delta Green?
I wouldn't say that, honestly. They definitely dip into the historical period a bit, but the stories in that book essentially run from, I think Corn King is like 1993, roughly, and Rules of Engagement is 99. So they cover the better part of the 90s, basically. It's sort of the decade wrapping around when the Delta Green source book came out. But in Rules of Engagement, for example, we dig into the 60s a fair amount. There's a couple of pretty important flashbacks that happen in Cambodia. In the late 60s, or maybe early 70s, I forget now, as well as an attempt at assassinating Stephen Alziz from Delta Green, who's the, you know, kind of Nyarlathotep avatar in New York City. There's a historical incident, as so much of our stuff is based on, in the late 60s when a group of U.S. soldiers attempted to murder a guy on an airplane, and the plane crashed, and it's not really clear. Like, they were clearly acting on orders, and this plane went down in China someplace, I think. And they were there to assassinate someone, basically. And it's not really clear, as I recall, who they were after or what the deal was, but it was some kind of a, you know, CIA-led operation that went poorly, and the plane crashed and went down with all hands. It's kind of one of the mysteries of the war. And that historical incident sparked my version in the Delta Green Rules of Engagement, where the target is Stephen Alziz. And there's these, you know, Delta Green agents who are on board to do this police mission, and things go horribly wrong and so forth. And so much of the first story in the book is about Nels and Reginald Fairfield, who is the circa 80s and early 90s is kind of the modern leader of Delta Green up until before Joe Camp takes it over. And Fairfield's a main character in The Corn King, and his fate and his history with Delta Green are very much a preoccupation, kind of a subtext of Rules of Engagement. So that contemporary history going from the 70s through the 90s is very much what I'd say Rules of Engagement is about.
Well, it sounds really good, and I'm sure anybody who's a fan of Cthulhu, Delta Green, that whole genre is really going to enjoy it. And, you know, I know you've been a fan of H.P. Lovecraft, obviously, for a very long time. So that begs the question, which is your favorite story?
It's a great question. I think the one that I've read the most is probably The Outsider. That's kind of The Outsider in many ways to me is kind of the archetypal Lovecraft story. It's got all the great sepulchred, grave rot, stench kind of stuff. But it also has the great sort of, you know, medical twist at the end of, you know, we're the monsters or whatever. And so to me, like it, you know, a lot of other Lovecraft stories are kind of just working out in different ways the themes that he established with The Outsider. And The Outsider is also a very poignant autobiography in some ways of Lovecraft and how he grew up and how he felt as a person. And kind of his awakening to who he was and what his legacy was and so on. And so I think it has, it's just a really potent package. It's very tight, which is a great quality in a short story. But I think if I had to choose like a more sort of, you know, like objectively good favorite story of Lovecraft's, I would probably pick The Colorado Spades. I think that's where Outsider is more of a personal kind of horror. Colorado Space is absolutely the emblematic cosmic horror story, where this, you know, these people undergo this horrifying decline, and it's through a color. I mean, like it's hard to even, you know, like say it simpler than that. I mean, a color is what is destroying them. And it's such a bizarre idea, and so kind of communicates that alien cosmology of just like whatever is going on here, you can't even begin to understand it. You can only say, well, it's kind of a color, I guess. And it's also really, it's very creepy. It's got great detail. It's very down to earth. It's this very, you know, this kind of pedestrian lives, this farming family, and how they all fall apart. And it's a really good, tight, creepy story that also straddles, as Lovecraft did so brilliantly, the worlds of science fiction and horror. You know, that was one of his, I think one of his great innovations was realizing that you could take the kind of stuff that H.G. Wells or Jules Verne had come up with, had innovated on with all this kind of science fictional ideas, some actual research, and then apply them towards, you know, this sort of more traditional kind of ghost story, terror tale kind of field. And Lovecraft married those two worlds brilliantly. And Colorado Space is probably the perfect example of that. I was going to say, when I was in Boy Scouts, the masters told us this ghost story about the ruins of a farmhouse near the campsite we always used. And it was a great ghost story. And it was essentially some kind of like three-legged creature or man that murdered everyone in the house or something was the short version of it. But it was the creepy, like, isolated farmhouse with a mysterious, you know, thing outside of it and so forth. And I think that hearing that ghost story as a kid in Scouts also really primed me to be just completely creeped the hell out by the Colorado Space as well, which is great.
Well, John, I'm looking forward to getting my own copy of Strange Authorities, but I think we've reached the end of the interview, and I want to thank you for all the time that you've given us. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been a blast.